You've got to be kidding me. I've talked to people who buy upwards of £100,000 loudspeakers, and if you went to them and say, "I want to put these absorbers in your room," they'd go, "You are not ruining my decor."
We are back, episode 31, season 2 of Not an Audiophile, the podcast. Today, Peter Como is on the line to answer my oddball questions. He has the knowledge as the director of acoustic design at IAG and a lifetime of hi-fi experience, manufacturing, selling, and writing about it, not to mention all the design work that he does at IAG for Wharfdale Mission. Let's get to it. Not an Audiophile is a media partner of the 2025 StereoNet Hi-Fi and AV Show. This year, it's bigger than ever. Hi-fi, home cinema, headphones, 3 days of what is basically a home entertainment expo from the 29th to the 31st of August in Melbourne, Pullman Hotel. More details at stereonet.com. Peter, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure to talk to you.
You've been interviewed enough times that you've covered most of your thoughts on loudspeaker design. So I thought I'd ask a few slightly different questions, of course, and ones that I suppose are of personal interest to me. But I feel like, as I put to you, that balance of a loudspeaker is kind of the thing that you notice first when when someone switches the system on. The balance between treble and bass, but also just the balance through the mid-range is kind of, I guess it's the character of the loudspeaker. Is that something you would agree with?
Well, I think it's the character of the whole hi-fi system. I think your original question was, how do you engineer a speaker or any hi-fi component, for that matter, more for music so it's less hi-fi? And that is the question of balance. When I discovered this when I was selling hi-fi equipment, first of all in London and then back down in my hometown in the UK, Plymouth, where I was managing a shop. And we were really drawing a distinction that even then between hi-fi and what we considered to be music playing systems, because everybody that came in wanted a hi-fi, but the reason they wanted a hi-fi was to play music. They didn't come in and go, oh, what's the bass like? What's the mid-range like? What's the treble like? They came in really wondering, "What? I've got a bunch of records or tapes, and how do I get more enjoyment out of the music on these things?" So I borrowed a term from the classical music repertoire called musical. And musical, as far as I understand it, is in the musician's part of the world, is about when performers bring a composition to life in a way that they believe the composer intended. Because, you know, as a musician, you can go and play all the notes in all the right order, but it doesn't mean that it grabs people emotionally.
Indeed.
So I felt that was a good term to apply to certain pieces of hi-fi equipment that I was selling at that time. For instance, the Linsondec LP12, which grabbed the emotion of the listener in a way that made music more enjoyable. And then when I started writing for hi-fi magazines, I started using this term musical, and it caught on.
Hang on.
Yeah.
Okay. So you invented the expression musical, because it is kind of it's an important term, isn't it? Because, and in fact, your description of the reason for that term is, of course, the best I've heard. But then you are the inventor of the term. So I mean, that's a great trinket, because it's such a, like you say, you can play the notes, but that doesn't make you a musician, right? So, and it doesn't create, as you say, an emotionally grabbing piece of music. And so do go on. But I mean, I love that. I mean, that is the best analogy or the best descriptor of the term. a musical hi-fi system that I probably ever heard. And did you invent any other terms that we should know about?
Well, let's for a start, I didn't invent the term. I borrowed the term and brought it into the I borrowed it and brought it into the realm of hi-fi, because it was the only way I could easily think in print of how to get across the idea that a piece of equipment was actually relaying the emotion in the music. The emotion, of course, that comes from the performance. And there were some pieces of equipment that did that really well. And if you cast your mind back to the late 70s, early 80s in hi-fi, for those of you who've ever looked at the history, or for those of you who are as old as me and can remember that, that era, there was a great axis between Lynn Products and Name Audio.
Indeed.
Because both of them were producing equipment which had those virtues of this adjective that I called musical.
Indeed.
And it's very non, it's although it's obviously bound up in hi-fi, it's very non, what I would call non-audiophile, because it's not rooted into frequency response or distortion or anything other than you can measure. There's something else going on, which at first I found almost inexplicable. But later on, when I started designing equipment, I began to realize that when you start tinkering, for example, with loudspeaker crossovers, that it is actually all a question of balance, which brings us right back to your first question, which is, why do things need to sound balanced? Well, I've been musing on this for some years now.
Yeah.
And the conclusion that I've come to, and it is only my opinion, I'm not saying this should be written in law or anything else, but it is only my opinion, is that inside our heads, we have the world's finest graphic equalizer. Now, we know that it works because if I'm talking to you in, say, your lounge, which has presumably some soft furnishings in it and is reasonably absorbent, and Indeed. We move into your kitchen, which is full of hard surfaces and little absorbency, your voice still sounds the same to me. But if I was to make a tape recording of your voice in your lounge and then move into the kitchen, it would change dramatically, especially if I made that recording in mono.
Okay.
So obviously what is going on inside our heads when we walk into the kitchen from your front room is that our brain is immediately receiving all these signals which are bouncing off the hard surface of your kitchen and re-equalizing the frequency response that is in our heads so that your voice still sounds like your voice. And that's why I say we have inside our heads the world's finest graphic equalizer. Now, that's okay. It means that actually when you sit down, for example, with, let's say, a pair of speakers which have a very exaggerated high frequency response, and I'll come back to that later.
Yeah.
When you've sat down for some time with these speakers, maybe for a few days, your brain sorts out what should be going on and flattens the response, and everything sounds okay. The most extreme example I ever came across with this was when I went to visit somebody who had a pair of louthers.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how many people know about louthers, but they are very odd, full-range loudspeakers with extremely lightweight paper cones and a whizzer cone in the middle that produces the high frequencies. And they do not have a flat frequency response. They sound immediately, you listen to them, or certainly when I first listened to them, as very coloured and very skewed response-wise. And I mentioned this to the guy who owned them, and he said, no, they're the world's perfect loudspeakers as far as I'm concerned. Every other speaker I listen to sounds wrong.
Well, no doubt it does.
Now, if think about the fact that when he sits down to listen to a pair of speakers, he engages that filter in his brain, which compensates for his louthers, then yes, every other speaker is going to sound wrong. Just His loudest sounded wrong to me.
Well, no doubt they would have, because they're quite strikingly coloured when you first hear them. In fact, when you hear most enthusiasts' pet systems, they tend to have some obvious colorations which they clearly have either become used to or enjoy.
So let's come back to balance, because that's the important aspect of this. And I think the factor in this that I found out with regard to musicality is that if your brain's having to do all this hard work trying to correct a system which is skewed in terms of balance, then it feels slightly uncomfortable. It's having to, it, you're not relaxed, you're sitting there in a state of tension. Because you're trying to, your brain is trying to figure out, for example, when you listen to a piano, why the overtones, the harmonics of the piano, are not matched to the fundamentals. When you listen to a violin, why are the overtones so harsh in that hypothetical speaker with an exaggerated high frequency response? Why are the overtones increase so much compared to the fundamental? And why do I have to work so hard to try and balance it again? Now, obviously, all this is happening in your subconscious. You're not aware of it. But what you are aware of is this feeling of tension. And because you're tense, because you realize that you're listening to something which is unbalanced, you cannot relax into the music. And when you can't relax into the music, you can't grab that emotional aspect of the music, which is so rewarding. So that is why we should aim for balance.
I love that, Peter. Thank you. That's a beautiful explanation. And I guess, yes, the pain in your brain doing all that processing to kind of, I mean, it's not quite processing to EQ it back to flat or vaguely natural sounding, but and I guess that's where the term natural sounding comes in. I mean, implying that the loudspeaker has a similar balance to how you would hear the instrument in a fairly neutral acoustic space, or maybe in a concert hall or something. Is that, do you think, speaking of terms, is that a reasonable description of natural, or is natural
Yeah,
not, yeah.
well, I was talking to a hi-fi reviewer the other day who judges the components that he's listening to by listening to classical music and jazz and well-recorded jazz music. And he was saying, I don't understand. He was in Canada. And he was saying, I don't understand you guys in the UK. So all your reviewers over there tend to judge things by using rock music or electronic music. How can you ever judge whether anything's natural? I think you can, because we can always rely on vocals, can't we?
Well,
I mean,
yes.
we know what the human voice should sound like, so at least you've got that to go by. But to
Well,
a certain
yes.
extent, I think it certainly helps if you do go to concerts and you listen to things live, because then you do get a better idea, especially. Classical and jazz, because then you do get a better idea of what real instruments sound like. You don't have to do that.
Now, there's an interesting thing though, that the Lowther listener or owner, when he goes to a concert, must have to make that equalization. I mean, he's not thinking about it. His brain ear combination is making that adjustment. I mean, how
No,
quick?
he doesn't. No, because he's not listening to a loudspeaker. The point is that our brains are really, really clever,
Well, I mean, yeah,
and
my
you say they're
question,
not processing, but they
yeah.
are doing an incredible amount of processing all the time.
Yeah, even,
And
yes, even though it's a natural
when he
sound.
goes to a concert, he knows he's going to listen to real instruments, so he switches his fil he switches his
Well,
speaker filter off.
but that's my question, Peter, is that he actually, so almost instantaneously he can de-equalize. Is that what you're saying? And but then you did, because you said you walk from the lounge to the kitchen, and your brain makes an immediate correction, if you like. So so it does happen
Yeah, because
that.
it's focusing on your vocal quality, not the surrounding quality. And in terms of rooms, this is something else that we all naturally filter. So when we're sitting in our listening rooms, and we're listening to a pair of speakers, we engage the filter which balances the sound in our room. And that's an interesting one as well.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I have a little bit of a, we've all got our little annoyances, I suppose. And I did mention also to you that there seems to be a strong push towards some kind of review quality room where you can only review hi-fi equipment in a special space, which seems to me counterintuitive when 99% of customers who buy a stereo system probably don't have a special space. Then maybe the question to yourself as a designer is, do you design for special spaces that only reviewers have and people who have gone to the trouble of correcting their poor quality acoustics, or do you design for a typical lounge room? Or do you not think about it?
Don't think about it.
Don't think
We
about
have at our dis yeah,
it.
we have at our disposal. We have completely, fully acoustically corrected rooms,
Yes.
which sound very dry and pretty boring, actually, I must say.
Yeah.
But they do enable you to hear exactly what a piece of equipment is doing.
Yes.
And in terms of getting things like direct axial response and balance right, they're very useful, but they're not much use for designing speakers which are going to be used in the home. So for that, we have other rooms, which are much more lively. And of course, I also take products home because I want to know what it's like to live with a design. And B, because I can engage other people, like my wife, who's got very keen ears. In other words, she knows what sounds exciting and musical and what sounds boring and not. And the fine tuning really is done with a balance of those things. Now, again, one of the things that I think a lot of certainly speaker designers in my acquaintance seem to have forgotten over the years. This was known in the 70s and 80s, then conveniently forgotten about, and then resurrected in the 2000s. And that is that the reflected response off the room surfaces from a loudspeaker must match that of the axial response if the speaker isn't going to sound coloured. That was the biggest problem with the Lowthers, by the way. And so we can actually manipulate the performance of the loudspeakers so that we get that right. Nowadays, we've got a term for it called the directivity index, and you can, even look at YouTube videos of people who investigate these things and see how the directivity index works theoretically. But it all comes back to this balance, that the balance of the sound bouncing off the walls of your room must be the same as the balance of the sound reaching you direct from the speakers. Otherwise, you hear it as coloration. And your ear and brain are very, very good at detecting this.
So is that perhaps you obviously feel that it is. Is that one of the key sort of creators of coloration, is that the on-axis response is dramatically different, perhaps, or just somewhat different to the off-axis response? That's what you're driving at, I take it. You'd like to have this sort of not omnidirectional loudspeaker, but certainly one with a very even roll off of output across all frequencies as you move away from the direct on axis position. That's what you're saying effectively, is it, Peter?
Especially with the, let's say, the 30 degree off axis response, because that's the one which you're going to hear bounced off the side walls of your room. And this is actually where you don't want to put room treatment, in my estimation. A lot of people do. I've seen a lot of reviewers' houses where they've got a lot of absorbency on the side walls of their room. And I think that it leads back to a very dead sounding experience. You want that reflection because it fills the room, it fills the sound out in your room. It gives you a much bigger feeling of space.
Yeah,
I laugh when I read reviews of people saying, reviewers saying, "Oh, there wasn't much width with these speakers. I couldn't hear anything outside the space between the boxes." And I think, yeah, you couldn't because you've got absorbers on the sidewalls of your room.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. You're supporting my case a little bit because it does. I think part of my concern about that as well is that these absorbers are probably quite ineffective at most frequencies, and so kind of unbalancing the sound. And I think the reason this is as someone who's not a qualified expert in any way, but I feel as if foam absorbers probably only work above, I don't know, 1500 hertz or something, and so you get this quite. I think the dryness is that sucked out feeling is because largely that it's kind of it makes it. You've gone to this trouble of engineering a very well balanced speaker off axis, and then they've kind of ruined it. Is that something? Am I on the right track, do you think?
Yeah, that's certainly. I can certainly pick out particular reviewers that, and one very, very famous magazine where this is a distinct problem. But there's nothing I can do about it. They want to listen in this sort of semi-anechoic environment,
Yes.
and I just don't get it because it's not relating to how people are going to use those products at home.
No, I suspect if you're building $300,000 loudspeakers, you can kind of make them. I mean, you perhaps also almost should be laying down the rules for how, the kind of space that they should be in. But when you're building something that's quite affordable,
You've got to be kidding. You've got to be kidding me. I've talked to people who buy upwards of £100,000 loudspeakers, and if you went to them and say, "I want to put these absorbers in your room," they'd go, "You are not ruining my decor. I've spent a millions with an interior designer coming up with the looks of this house. You are not going to stick these horrible bits of foam all over my wall."
No, there is that, of course, but for getting back to the affordable end of the market, the reality is that I would suspect, and I guess you might agree, based on you've speak to people at shows that have bought your various products that you've created over many years, that they are not in acoustically correct rooms, if that's even a thing, because really what you've just said, and I'm putting forward, is that they're not acoustically correct. They're acoustically sort of odd in a way because they're sucked out at certain frequencies. They're quite reflective at other frequencies, lower frequencies, I guess, and maybe very high frequencies. They're actually quite unbalanced. But then no room is perfect, right, I suppose.
You can make a perfect room. Well, I say perfect in that you will hear the direct response from the speakers very, very clearly, but it's a pretty unemotional experience because what you're wanting from a hi-fi system is something which is almost a fantasy. You're taking two transducers in the room for a stereo system, which is what most audiophiles listen to. And you're basically saying, what is the space that these performers are recorded in? What is this acoustic space that I'm trying to place these instruments and vocalists in? And if you're listening in a very dry and very well damped and acoustically treated room, you don't get much impression of that. You
No.
usually can hear things spaced out very clearly in between the speakers, but they are very much associated with the speakers generally. Whereas what you want is something that's maybe either, I've talked to people who want to sit in the stalls, and I've talked to people who want to sit in the balcony. The people who want to sit in the balcony want a very distant view of what's going on. The people who sit in the stalls want something happening right in between the speakers or projected in front of the speakers. But that illusion is something that we're trying to generate with a hi-fi system.
Indeed.
And you need an acoustic space to put those transducers in if you're going to generate that illusion.
So I feel my advice sometimes to people is that if you've got carpet in the room and some soft furnishings by way of a lounge and or lounges, chairs, and some drapes, etc., you probably actually don't need a lot more absorption, particularly if you then put a few humans in the room and a dog or something. I mean, that's probably nearly enough absorption in your average room, lounge room,
Yeah,
do you think?
bookshelves help as well. The enemies are exposed hard flooring and glass. Those are your biggest problems.
Yes, shiny, hard, large areas of flat surface, I guess, that create nasty, harsh, or hard reflections. And but if yeah, if you've got a certain amount of soft furnishings, then from there on, if you were going to treat the room acoustically, you would probably add more diffusion than you would add absorption, perhaps. Is that if assuming you could do it over a fairly broad frequency range, do you think? Or do you have any strong thoughts on that?
You can add diffusers by all means. As I said, bookcases,
Yeah, yes.
they're your friends.
Yes,
They can
indeed.
do wonderful
They
things.
kind of are. It's a shame that, I suppose these days, with the way things have gone in the hi-fi industry, the bookcase is replaced with the giant rack of records. And if you were to leave various slots between the records, you could create some kind of quasi-diffuser, I guess. But I just.
The other one to mention, which I forgot about, is the big screen TV, because that's a huge area of glass. And of course, where are you going to put that? Between your speakers.
Just where you really don't want it, I guess.
So when you're listening to when you're listening to stereo and you're not watching video, throw a blanket over it.
Do you do that yourself, Peter, is a question I really should ask. Because it's
No, the TV's at the opposite end of the room.
okay. So no home cinema at your house?
No, we sort of gave up home cinema, really. I think I'd love home cinema, but I'd have it in another room if I was going to do it.
Indeed.
I wouldn't have it in my music room.
Well, I have other questions, but for the moment, we're going to take a 2 second break. Hey Now Hi-Fi specializes in creating personalized audio experiences with brands to suit all needs and over 3 decades of experience. Jeff from Hey Now Hi-Fi can help find your sound for your life. Have a look at the website now. Not right now. You're listening to the podcast later, but soon. I sort of left off with the expensive drive unit thing, and I know, I realize in the designs that you, in fact, there's two parts to this question. The drive unit cost, it's one of those, it feels like they it blows out exponentially. And I did mention an example, the ScanSpeak elliptical range, particularly the mid-range, which is ultimately just a dome mid-range, but costs an enormous amount of money. Do you feel that there is, I mean, I guess it's diminishing returns, but what are your thoughts on those outrageously expensive drive units? And I guess you're in a position at your company to build something very, very close for, I imagine, significantly less.
Well, first of all, as a loudspeaker designer, you should always be looking at new developments. And elliptical is one of the things that we've been working with on ScanSpeak, because we do use ScanSpeak in our top of the line models,
Okay.
like Wharftail Elysium. So it's a very interesting technology. I think we will be using it in the future. But we won't be using it in their standard range, their super duper range. They've introduced elliptical as a technology, but they've also put it into their luxury, what I call their luxury range of drive units. And when companies like us work with them, we can basically dictate the materials and everything that we want to use. And we do that with respect to cost. So, because cost is an important thing for the brands that I'm managing, we're not super high end. We don't want to be super high end. The reason I don't want to be super hen, by the way, is because I like to get my products into the hands of as many people as possible. I love the idea that tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, in some cases for some products, of people around the world are enjoying music more because they're using my designs. So the idea of
Yes.
building something that costs $100,000 is a bit of an anathema to me because it means that I'm probably only going to sell, one or two a month. And that's not really where I want to be.
No. I guess that you're philosophically, you've just stated your case. You'd prefer to have more of your good sounding loudspeakers in more hands than just a few examples spread thinly around the world. And I guess, do you have much of a feeling on the diminishing returns thing? I mean, clearly this is the case. I mean, in fact, walking around Munich this year from room to room, and I made in a 2 second conversation that we had, I made the comment, which you won't remember, but I made the comment that it was like a breath of fresh air to walk into a more affordable room, and I wasn't really sure why. And I wonder whether it partly goes back to what we discussed previously with coloration. I don't know. I'm not suggesting higher end, more expensive products are colored, but there was something. Maybe I was just relaxed the fact that my wallet could actually afford the products that were in your room and a couple of the other more affordable rooms that I went into. Maybe I just relaxed and was in a. I don't know. It was mentally in a better state for enjoying the music because I could actually afford the products playing. But there's something very nice, very balanced, very easy to listen to about, well, the new Evos that were playing. That was just nice to walk into and away from some of the sometimes. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't use the word coloured in relation to the super high end. But do you have thoughts on the super high end?
Well, first of all, let's look at cost because if you're going to be making one or two products a month, then it's got to cost a lot of money in order to cover A, your research and development, and B, the fact that your manufacturing facility is not working flat out.
Indeed.
So add to that the cost of the materials, the drive units, and so on that go in to these products, and you can understand why they are so expensive. But in terms of what happens at these high-end shows, I actually follow the edict that was given to me by Ivor Tiefenbrunn of Lynn Products back in the day when I was a journalist, because he when he first started selling the Lynn LP12, it was partnered with the Grace G707 tone arm and Supex 900E cartridge.
Yes.
And I still think to this day that a more musical combination has yet to be achieved.
Okay.
But I asked him, how did you discover these products? How did you know that they would work with your turntable? Did you go around the world trying out different tone arms and different cartridges until you found them? And he said, no, he said, it's quite easy. I walk down the corridors of shows,
Okay.
and when I'm passing an open doorway, if I hear a noise coming out, I'll walk on. If I hear music coming out, I'll
Yes.
go in and find out and try and figure out what it is that's making that music.
Yeah, okay.
And that's a strategy that I think works even today. Coincidentally, my wife and daughter were over at Munich High End last year, and they spent some time, obviously, in the IG room, and then went around the exhibition. And they came back a couple of hours later with a very puzzled look on their faces.
Yeah.
I said, "What's up?" They said, "How come every room sounds worse than yours?" Now, I mean, okay, there's some personal bias in there,
Well,
but
maybe a
I
little,
think
but yeah.
the Yeah, but I think the reason that you felt comfortable when you walked into our room is that we were playing music, we weren't playing hi-fi.
Yeah, I sort of feel that's well, okay, here's my take, and you might be able to add a certain amount of technical theory to my experience, and that is that I do walk around as I've been going to Munich and other shows, obviously Vegas back in the days when it was more of a hi-fi thing, and you do skip past a lot of rooms. Yeah, that's, yeah. You know, you literally hear a bit of sound leaking out the door. Now, this, to some casual listeners, is going to sound a bit dismissive, but it's really not, because if you've been to enough shows, you don't have time really to listen to every room, obviously, and you do become a bit dismissive. But you discover some real gems, and the price is quite often high, but quite often very affordable. And that's the defining thing. There's this, I guess we used the term previously, musicality or a naturalness of the sound, but there's a rightness to the sound, and it draws you in, and you go into the room and it washes over you, and it's delightful. And the price isn't the arbiter of that experience, I think.
Yeah, it's feeling comfortable that I think is the main thing. I mean, we go back to what I said in part one, that if you're not feeling comfortable, you can't enjoy the music.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a lot of product designed which is designed for what I would call audiophile sensibilities.
Okay.
The sort of people who, if you go around to their house, they'll play you 30 seconds of one track, and then they'll go, oh, listen to the drums on this, and they'll play you another 30 seconds of another track. Yep. But they'll never play an album all the way through.
Yeah.
That's a different type of customer.
Yes.
And those people, I see them come into the rooms, the demonstration rooms that we have, and they do what I call the audiophile pose. They sit in the chair,
yes,
and they lean forward. And if they could, they'd put their hands behind their ears. But they're looking forward with this intense concentration on their face.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can almost know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
They're trying to separate out what the bass is like, what the mid-range is like, what the treble is like.
Yeah.
And with my designs, I put a lot of effort into making sure you can't hear those things. I want the whole speaker to be a complete whole speaker. It's not separated into three bands like that. You know, it just plays music. And after a while, they sit back and they're looking really confused. And at that point, they'll either get up and walk out, or they'll hopefully begin to enjoy the music. But it does confuse people, because very often when you walk into rooms which are dedicated to the audiophile, the treble will be extremely finely etched and detailed and will rip your ears off if you're in there for more than 10 minutes. And the mid-range will be cutting edge to a point where, you know, it doesn't sound like people singing. It sounds like some awful squawk down the telephone. But it's this finely etched, extremely present, forced presentation that seems to get audiophiles excited, and that's fine for them. If they want that, that's great. Go ahead and buy it. That's great. But having said, you know, this doesn't happen to every high end. There are high end designers out there who are doing a really, really good job, even with such things which seem ridiculous, like high-end DACs. You know, they actually do work, because the people who are designing them, they're going after the music, and they understand that. And that's great. So, you know, I'm not condemning all high-end.
No,
it's just that some of the things which I try and listen to, because people say, oh, you must go and listen to this. I just find, well, no, it's not for me.
Yeah, well, and look, there is a little bit of personal taste in it, I guess, but then that is the choice of the audiophile. If they want to pursue that, I guess that's fine. But if you're a music lover, you really just want a system that I feel that plays music. Moving on from that, I appreciate your input on that, but part of perhaps an extension of that commentary or conversation is horn-loaded loudspeakers, which, I mean, historically were always, of course, for throwing, you know, louder sounds down a giant auditorium, but there seems to be more and more horn-loaded loudspeakers in the audio, home audio space. I mean, there's a few historical players like the Klipschs of the world who have always done it, but I've noticed they seem to be sounding better. Maybe my ears have gotten old and I'm less sensitive to some of the what I would correctly, otherwise incorrectly or correctly call colorations. But Do you have any thought on horns? I mean, are they something that you've heard some that you like? Because when they get it right, they do have this kind of, I don't know, they have a certain way about them, which is very enjoyable and relaxing.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll tell you another little story about
sure.
that.
Yeah, do that.
When I was in retail, I was doing the Ivor Tiefenbrunn thing and walking around shows, and I passed by one door, and there was some absolutely fantastic music coming out. So I went in, really strange demo. I looked at it, and I couldn't understand it at all. There was some enormous speakers in the corner of the room. And then in the middle was this little tiddly valve amplifier
with a
couple of tubes. And I thought, what the hell is this? So, because it was really sounding, very enjoyable.
Yes.
I walked up to the guy and I said, what have you got playing here? And he said, oh, this is the Klipsch Corner horn.
Oh, okay.
And I'd heard horns before and discounted them completely. And I said, this is working really well for a horn system. So he explained a bit about it. And then I said, well, what's this amplifier you're driving it with? He said that it's a 2-watt single-ended tube amp.
2 watts?
He said, yeah, because these speakers are so sensitive.
Yes.
And what that gives you is what the speaker sensitivity gives you is a tremendous dynamic range.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because you're not stressing the amplifier. In fact, you're not stressing any of the components. So I have a lot of time for that. But I felt that the reason this was a very early Klipsch corner speaker, I don't know how it compares to the ones that they've been producing more recently, but when it was under Paul Klipsch, it was done really well.
Hmm.
But I don't know quite what a lot of the current horn designers are aiming at, because they all seem to be designing freestanding horns.
Mm.
And that seems to me like you're trying to battle against room acoustics rather than use them. The great thing about the Klipsch corner horn was that the horn extended into the room. The room was the extension of the horn.
Yes. Yeah,
and I think that's a great way to go. And if I was going to design a horn, that's where I'd start, as a corner horn.
So, okay, so your retirement gift to yourself is a Peter Como version of a Klipsch corner horn. is that my takeaway from that?
I'd like to give it a go just to see what would happen. It would involve a lot of work because I know next to nothing about horn design. And you're right, they are getting better. Some of the stuff that JBL's doing now is pretty good. Still think I got it wrong in that they're marrying horns to normal bass units. If you're going to do the horn thing, then go all out for this high sensitivity. That's where you really benefit.
Yeah, so the sensitivity is an important part of the equation. So you're really aiming for 95 dB or something like that.
More than that.
More than that.
98,
okay.
Please.
Yeah. Oh, really?
98. Okay. yeah. Because the other thing I found out because obviously, I work with the amplifier designers at IAG and work very close with Jan Ertner, the designer for Quadron Audio Lab. And a long time ago, when I was working, producing my own amplifiers for Haybrook, not my own designs, but we manufactured them to Tim DeParavicini's designs.
Okay.
One of the things that I found out was that the reason that you can get away with a 15-watt tube amplifier, you call them tubes in Australia, right?
Yeah, no, we're happy with tubes. Well, I think historically back when valves were actually the way that you amplified sound before transistors, people were calling them valves, but tubes now seems to be the popular term.
Yeah, we still call them valves in the UK, but I think that's we're the only ones. 15-watt tube amp You could use it up to its absolute maximum, and it wouldn't ever betray itself. But with solid state amps, as the power goes up, they get worse. And my general feeling is that most solid state amps are only usable over the first third of their capability. Push them beyond that, and they begin to harden up and change character. Not all of them do that. We've recently done, or rather Jan has done, with my feeding in the information from the original Quad 303. Now, the original Quad 303, Peter Walker and others came up with this concept of the quad triples, which was a three stages coupled to the output stage. So it was driver, pre-driver, and output transistors all coupled into one closely knit group, which they called the output triples stage. And the great thing about that was that all the feedback was localized around it, so it was self-governing, if you like. And the incredible thing about that is it doesn't change character as you increase power. So that was an interesting exercise to go through. But generally, if you can put less stress on all your components, whether it's amplifier components or speaker components, everything sounds, I think, sounds much better, much more relaxed, and everything behaves better. So yeah,
Keeping
that's the advantage you get with horns.
excursion, I guess, down to to, like you say, perhaps a quarter or a third of its ultimate capability has got to make for cleaner sound, one assumes.
Yeah, everything's working in a more linear fashion.
I guess this is going off at a tangent a little bit. I've got two tangents that I want to hit you with. One is your job, official title, if you like, at IAG, is Director of Acoustic Design. Some people listening might wonder, including myself, what do you do all day? Because I feel like the bit of the job that you really love must be being handed a clean piece of paper, and we want to do this. And then you let your imagination run wild. But I do wonder how much of your day, where do you really get to ponder new designs and work on existing designs that you're improving or what have you, and how much is boring paperwork and writing reports and, that kind of thing. I mean, it must be the best job in the world, is the way I think of it.
Well, I think it is, but then, I wouldn't be doing it at the age I am now if it wasn't for the fact that I love it. Because my idea all through my life, ever since I left university, was if a job ends ever up feeling like work, then I change my job. This would drive my parents crazy because I, leave one job after another. But I've ended up in a job that I absolutely adore, and that's why I keep doing it. Anyway, come back to your question. First of all, I don't ever get a clean sheet of paper, because we have to work with a marketing department who are very hot on keeping up with what the customer wants. So we know within each brand, or rather they know within each brand, where things are going, what the customer's looking for. And we talk and talk and talk about that, in order to come up with new ideas, new concepts for new products. And occasionally, I'll throw in an oddity like the original, the Wharfedale 80th anniversary Denton, which led to the Linton, which led to the Dovedale, and so on, and the whole Heritage series, and that came out of just my brainstorming. But generally, it's where can we take our customer who's looking for a certain something? What can we offer them that gives them something new and exciting? So that's where the designs come from. And then it's really down to, okay, what can we put into these designs, which is more advanced than what we've done before? What have we learned over the past couple of years? Because, 2 to 3 years is the general life of the product, that helps us make more advances. And most of that we do through listening, discussion, and research. And it's all good fun. It's all good
Oh,
fun.
I'm pretty sure it is. But it must mean that you're incredibly busy. There's such a broad range of models and in fact brands as well. Why have we got sorry about the phone message coming through. It's I mean and the and then the second sort of off at a tangent thing is that Castle is a brand that I would imagine you're responsible for as well. Is that right?
That's what I'm working on now, actually.
Yeah, well, that's maybe it's a we didn't. Oh, I'm sorry about the phone noises. We'll edit that out. So I'll re-mention Castle.
I
You can't
can't
hear
hear
it?
him yet.
Yeah, it's
No.
frustrating.
Yeah.
So Castle Acoustics. I feel. Do you have a sort of? I mean, my question is really, if you're working on a Castle, do you have an old pair of Castles kicking around, or something you buy and you analyze sort of, or do you know from memory perhaps what that product kind of sounded like and the way it was back in the day and the kind of customer that wanted that sound, and then you sort of try to, I guess, build that into a new version of that sort of character, if you like. Is that part of the job?
Very much the case. I do remember Castle because I reviewed them when I was a journalist and talked to the designers about them, so I know where they're coming from. The two Castle speakers are out there now. The Earl and the Duke were actually I brought in Karlheinz, a good friend of mine, Karlheinz Fink, who works principally in Germany, but we've worked on lots of products before. And the reason we got to know each other was because we found that we had the same idea about hi-fi, that it has to play music, so that's great. He's very accomplished designer, and we brought him in to do the Earl and the Duke. But I'm working on some stuff now myself, and trying to pick up on what Castle did in their quarter wave loading, and further that on with the way that we know how these things work now. So I've got a very talented assistant who's a real brainy guy, first class honours degree out of Southampton University, and he's done a lot of the maths behind the theory that Castle were working with, and we've come up with something interesting. So watch
All
this
right.
space.
Is that months away or more of a year away, kind of? I mean, what is the lead time on these things?
I'm hoping it's going to be this year.
Okay, all right.
We're going through the listening stages and fine-tuning stages now. It's never easy to tell you how long those are going to take,
No.
because sometimes you can end up tuning things, and we don't release them until they're ready. And sometimes it can take months to do that.
Yes, that reminds me of a story you were telling about the mission products that you worked on during COVID, where you spent, well, I think your words were you had the luxury of a year or more, perhaps, but normally that would not be the case. The lead time, I guess, is, I mean, if you've got to try to get something designed and sorted out and passing the listening test within 6 months or something, is that sort of more the normal timeline or?
From concept to signing off the prototype is normally 6 to 9 months, and we put a lot of thousands of hours of listening into that time, obviously, because we have to get it right.
Yeah, well, I imagine you put thousands of hours of work in, like design and experimentation and, modeling, I would imagine as well. Maybe not thousands, I don't know. I mean, is it thousands of hours in each model?
It depends how quickly things come together. If we're working with what I would call known technology, like for instance, Evo 5, we just took the existing drive units out of Evo 4, refined them, added some new knowledge that we'd researched and materials that we'd researched and put that into it. But basically, they were, because we were working with drive units that we knew well, it cut down the development time, the listening time. It's still hundreds of hours went in there.
It comes back to what you were making the comment about high-end, low volume versus the more affordable products that IAG builds, and that the ability to, spread the cost, if you like, of that R&D, which is unavoidable no matter what kind of product you're designing. There's an enormous amount of time taken to get it right, and if you're only selling, like you say, a dozen pairs a year, it's a substantial chunk of money allocated to each pair. Whereas in your case, where you're, well, I have no idea of the volume. I mean, but I presume thousands of pairs, you can spread the cost, obviously, and it's a much smaller chunk of money per speaker. I'm going to take a quick break and get you back in a second to finish off on a couple of final questions, if that's all right, Peter.
It's fine by me.
An Australian loudspeaker legend has been born with the stunning new VAF Research i93 Mark V, winner of Stereonet's Floor Standing Loudspeaker Product of the Year and Sound and Image Magazine's Floor Standing Speaker of the Year, $20,000 to $50,000. VAF's i93 has redefined what I thought was possible from a loudspeaker in a domestic setting, says Stereonet. VAF Research, building award-winning loudspeakers in Australia since 1978. Would you say that the loudspeakers that in history everyone has enjoyed have generally had, good off-axis performance or an off-axis balance that's very similar to the on-axis? Do you think that's how it is, or is there some speakers that break that rule? We all know the classics.
There are always speakers that break that rule, but generally, yes, that's the case. The ones that sound most natural and easygoing and are comfortable to live with are the ones that do that. I mean, this stuff was known in the 70s and 80s by speaker designers, and then it was forgotten about for a long time.
Okay.
And then it reoccurred again. And then people like Floyd O'Toole and so on resurrected it and made sure it was well known again.
Yes.
But it's not something, it's not a new invention, but what we do have now is better ways of measuring it, which is great. The products that break with convention are the ones which I would call only suited to particular types of music. If you want something that's a hard-hitting rock loudspeaker, you might not care about coloration. You're more interested in dynamics and transients and something where the sound is being thrown at you rather than drawing you in, what I would call drawing you into the music.
So you would say then that scenario we're talking about where you're walking down the halls of a show and you hear something nice coming out, do you think that that's probably a system that has very even power response? Can we connect those two together?
I think you'd almost certainly find that, yeah.
Yeah. Your facilities at IAG, one imagines an enormous anechoic chamber is at your disposal, but is that still required, or is that something you do have access to, or is it just something that no longer is, you can use gated measurements using something like the Klippel system is even better, or what do you, or do you use a combination of all of the above?
We use a combination. We have a Klippel system. We have several anechoic chambers.
Of course you do. You have several anechoic chambers. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
How nice
some,
for you.
some extremely large, some medium sized, some small.
Okay.
And they give a different set of results than the Klippel NFS system does, because the Klippel NFS system, It's a tool like all tools.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good at some things, but it's extrapolating what something should work at, should perform like at 2 meters from very close measurement. And it is an extrapolation. It's
okay.
A computer simulation. Whereas when you actually go and measure in a large anechoic chamber what something's behaving like at 2 meters, it does measure slightly differently.
Okay.
It's an interesting contrast, but yeah, you have to use this stuff. Particularly the anechoic chambers are very good in allowing you to come up with your first prototype. So the way we design prototypes is we put everything together into a prototype speaker. We'll go into the anechoic chamber. We'll do a huge range of measurements, and then we'll put those into some very clever computer software, and that would enable us to design our first crossover. We build that false crossover, and we go into the listening room. And sometimes it sounds, oh yeah, this is what we can work with, and sometimes, my God, that's awful, and we go back and start again. So, this is the way that design should work, in that you're using the tools at your disposal to help you to come up with something which is a starting point. Trying to do it the other way around, I mean, I've been a reviewer, I know what it's like, but trying to do it the other way around, and that is do those measurements and then from that extrapolate whether something it performs correctly is much more difficult.
And a question before I forget. You mentioned measuring at 2 meters. Is that the advantage of the larger anechoic chambers? You can measure it two or even further away from the loudspeaker. Is
Yeah,
there
you
is.
need you. I mean, we can do measurements at 1 meter, and it will give us a certain set of results. But bear in mind that most listeners are 2 to 2.5 meters away from their speakers, so that's really where you want to be measuring.
And
Yeah,
really,
and
the
you need a big chamber
I
to
was
do
going to
that.
say the only way to really is it still, am I completely out of touch with reality, or is really the only way to measure at 2 or 2.5 meters is to have an anechoic chamber and a substantial one? Is that right?
Well, in Gilbert Briggs' day, they used to hoist the speaker up on a crane,
Well, there is that method outside, you mean.
10 meters above the ground. Yeah, you could do it
Well,
that
there is that. It's less than convenient, though, isn't it? So,
way. It certainly is.
you'd spend most of your day hoisting speakers up on cranes. And then, of
Yeah,
course.
but when I was doing the Mission 770 during COVID, I had to do that. I was out in the garden.
Oh, yeah, because so you designed a lot of that sort of at home or something, did you?
It was all had to be done at home. We were under lockdown in the UK. I don't know what you guys were doing in Australia.
Oh, we were just out surfing and drinking beer, but that's not true at all. I mean, it depend it actually we don't want to go sideways into COVID, but the funny thing with COVID is that Australia it dissolved itself, back to sort of a pre-federation scenario where the states were at war with each other and each state had a different set of rules. And I just happened to live in the wild west of Australia, which is not the west, but the equivalent of Texas or something, which is Queensland. And we had no rules really, except that we weren't allowed to go over to New South Wales. So there was this sort of barricade at the border. But largely, we did whatever we wanted. And to be honest, I didn't miss a day's work. So I just went in every day as per normal. In Victoria, on the other hand, they shut the state down for 2 years and kind of ruined it forever. Obviously, UK had the same set of rules all the way around the.
UK had one set of rules, which was complete lockdown.
Is that
I
right?
remember have I remember having Christmas dinner with my youngest daughter and husband. They were sitting outside in the freezing cold. We had the doors open to the extension of our kitchen, which has double doors out onto a patio. They were sitting out there and we were sitting inside. That's the ridiculous of it. However, it seems that looking back on it, that there weren't one set of rules, there were two set of rules. There was another set of rules for the
I was going
politicians,
to
the
say
people in the know,
the Prime Minister at the time.
who were partying away. But the astonishing thing was for us was we went over to visit our eldest daughter, who's living in Copenhagen. And it was like going back into freedom again.
Oh,
I
is that
mean,
right?
they They had the 2 meter rule, but that was it. 2 meters and masks, and that was it.
Okay.
You could do anything you like.
It was a it was a it, it there was a lot of variances in the rules, and there was a lot of variances in the success of these different rules, and I'm not sure that any conclusions can be drawn. But one conclusion I can draw is that people have forgotten about spreading those sort of it's not really a disease, perhaps, but I mean the whole virus on a plane thing. We're back to where we were pre-COVID, I think. There seems to be
Well, to
there's
a certain extent, I mean, there's the two things that I think came out of it. One is wash hands all the time. You know, every time you go outside, when you come back in, first thing, wash your hands. If you shake hands with somebody, for God's sake, get to the toilet and wash your hands as quickly as you can. That's one of the rules that I still follow. The other
Indeed.
one, which interestingly enough, still happens in China, was happening in China before, it's happening in Japan before. That is, if you feel sick, if you have a cold, wear a mask. Right? Your mask is there not to prevent you from catching something,
No.
although it does work, but your mask is mainly there to stop you spreading your germs, your disease to other people. And people in Asia have known this for decades, and they still
Well,
do it.
indeed, yes,
They
because
still do it.
you'd be at airports and you'd see, well, depending where the airport is, I guess, but there's certainly many Asian people traveling, well, living in Asia and traveling with masks on. And I guess I think I always felt that was to protect themselves, but if it's to protect others, then, well, that's great as well. And it's a very generous thing to do. But on that recent trip, to Germany, there's no masks being worn anywhere, and annoyingly, I managed to catch a cold yet again, not COVID that I'm aware of, but it's just it anyhow. We've covered politics, back to audio. Just glad it's over, really, and I hope we don't see anything like that again soon. Look, we'll probably wrap up shortly, Peter. I think that I'm going to postpone some of my questions to a time in the future when you're back in the UK and we've got slightly cleaner internet reception. I really appreciate your time this time.
My pleasure.
One final question. Actually, I mean, you've sort of already answered it. And that is that it seems like IAG philosophically will never enter into the high end, if you like, but or is there a secret project lurking somewhere that you dabble with in your spare time that's a more of a sort of an all-out effort using the incredible, I mean, you've got these enormous and you've got at least one enormous anechoic chamber, you've got obviously a fantastic woodworking factory, cabinet factory. All sorts of drive unit building capability, either in-house or subcontracted out or what have you. You could, as a group, certainly build, one would assume, a very, very competitive high-end product. Is it on the radar?
Well, let me approach it from a different direction because it's one of the things that really bugs me. And that is, people do not take what a lot of products that our brands do, they do not take them seriously, you know, because they are not expensive. And it drives me crazy because we, for example, when we introduced Elysian for Wolfdale, which was probably the most expensive product that Wolfdale had done for a long time. I remember taking it, going to one of the tours I did to demonstrate this was in Germany. And at one high-end store in Germany, we put the top of the range, the Elysian falls on, driven by some tube amps, and customers were just coming in to this evening do and having some snacks and drinks and sitting down with a glass of wine and listening to music. And it was great. Everybody was having a great time. The speakers sounded fantastic. It was very musical. This whole system was very musical. And it was thoroughly enjoyable. And then halfway through the evening, the store owner said, "Can I have a word?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And he took me outside. He took me into another of his den rooms. And he looked around and he said, Peter, what do I do with all these speakers now? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you're playing something which sounds absolutely incredible for a third of the price
Yes.
of what I'm looking at in this demo. He said, but how am I supposed to sell them? I said, look, you're probably going to be selling on brand name anyway, because people do that, right? They come in and they go, I want a pair of JBLs, or I want a pair of Focals. They don't come in and ask for a pair of Wolf Tones. And that for me is a big problem, because we do like to push boundaries. We are going to be pushing boundaries. For Wharfdale, we are going to go more expensive, but it's still going to be what I would call affordable. We're not going to go crazy, but it does annoy me that, for example, in Wharfdale, the Elysian series and the Aura series in particular, which I think are phenomenal performers for their price, don't get taken seriously because they are not expensive enough. And that's crazy, because what we're doing at IAG is we're bringing the economy of building things to a high performance, but at a reasonable price, to the marketplace, so that, like I said, we can get as many speakers into as many homes as possible. So
Indeed.
please, do take us seriously when we do this stuff.
I secretly, as someone who's, got a love for affordable mid-price products such as, Spendor, Proac, Neat, and, not to sound like a snob who will only listen to a product that's made in the UK, or of course an Australian-made loudspeaker, or an American-made loudspeaker, or a German-made loudspeaker. But I mean, I guess that the Chinese manufacturer is something some people would still cling to. But the Elysium loudspeakers are, I mean, they're embarrassingly exceptional. I don't want to sort of, blow smoke in your back pocket or whatever the expression is, but it's. I have heard them in a couple of different situations, and they are genuinely a. I mean, they are exactly what you say they are. They're very musical, very natural, very plenty of dynamics and excitement, and in no way are they fatiguing to listen to. So, a very accomplished design, but I guess they've still got a Wharfdale badge. So, does IAG invent their own brand?
No, launching a new brand. I mean, we've got enough brands to work with anyway.
Well, you kind of
Launching a new
have.
brand is hell. It's really, really difficult. Because when you go to dealers and they go, why do I need another brand? I've got enough already.
This is
You know,
right.
so you don't want to do that. But like I say, we are always pushing boundaries. And with Wharfdale, we're going to continue to do that. We're going to go up in price and just see how the market reacts.
No, you heard it here first, folks. Maybe you didn't, but anyhow, Peter's mentioned it, so I'll go with that. Hey, thank you again, Peter Como, for your Como. I believe the we're going to cover this. Correct pronunciation as you prefer is Como.
Yeah, it's an anglicised version, but I'm an anglophile, so.
Well, anyhow, we know who you are either way, and I thank you again for your time and your input and your thoughts and your philosophies. It's very much appreciated, and I'm pretty sure people are going to enjoy sort of getting some insight into how these designs get made, how they're thought through. Thank you again, Peter, and I'd love to speak to you when you're back in the UK.
Okay, I'm now going to go and make myself a cup of coffee using one of your Australian designs, the Breville espresso machine, which I think is absolutely brilliant. And it's been great talking to you.
No, Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you again.